This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. The question of what ultimately helps children succeed is a really thorny one. Parents debate it, politicians debate it, researchers debate it, but it's a question and a debate that's worth wading into because creating successful kids and ultimately successful adults is what society depends on. Paul Tuff has combed through the data, he's tracked kids, and he's tried to figure out what makes some so resilient while others struggle and stumble. Paul Tuff is the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Paul Tuff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to first start off with the thesis that I think a lot of people have, this idea that cognitive abilities, how well you do on tests, and these could be, the SAT test or, different states, of course, they have their own tests so that you can get out of junior high and high school, that these are the tests that really matter. Where did this assumption that we have come from?
I mean, I think it goes back a long way. So I call this in my book the cognitive hypothesis. And so in lots of ways it stretches back, this debate stretches back for decades and centuries. In terms of its contemporary incarnation, some of it goes back to this report that came out in the 1990s from the Carnegie Corporation that was specifically worried about the first few years of life and worried that kids weren't getting enough cognitive stimulation early on. And that in lots of ways started this anxiety, I think, among a lot of parents that felt like they had to give their kids really early on intensive cognitive stimulation. It created, the baby Einstein and all of the toys and tools that we now use for our kids early on. Created what a couple of economists I read about called the rug rat race.
And, when you look at the data that comes out of some of this sort of theory of cognitive ability, it's very striking. You cite one study in the book which looked at the number of words that kids from poorer families hear every day versus the kids of wealthier families. And by age three, the people with professional parents have heard about 30 million words. The kids with parents on welfare have heard about 10 million words. So small differences do add up. And that was part of convincing people, right, that this was an important hypothesis.
Yes. And I mean, the thing I need to say about the cognitive hypothesis is that it's partly true. I mean, cognitive ability really does matter. And being exposed to 30 million words before age three really is very different than being exposed to 10 million words before age three. But I think partly what was so appealing to us and what is so appealing to us about the cognitive hypothesis is that it has this very clear sense of cause and effect, right? That if it's as simple as that it's just, these kids just need 20 million extra words and all we need to do is just say 20 million extra words to them and they'll be fine. Whereas what I'm finding in the research that I'm looking at and the reporting I'm doing is that there's this other set of skills that matter at least as much, if not more, and that they are more complicated. They don't follow that same clear cause and effect.
And you point to a lot of different indicators of this, but one that I thought was really interesting was the work of a Nobel Prize winning economist, James Heckman, who has sort of thought a lot about kids and development. And one of the things he did was he looked at high school graduates and people who had taken the GED, which is the high school equivalency exam. They should be equal. And I wonder, what do you find when you can compare people who have graduated from high school with people who have taken a high school equivalency exam?
So Heckman is one of the people who really got me most interested in this research, and the GED was the study that really set him on the path to trying to find out more about these character strengths or non-cognitive skills. And so the GED in lots of ways is this perfect expression of the cognitive hypothesis, because what it says is that what matters in graduating from high school is cognitive ability. And so if you can pass a GED test, which is a measure of cognitive ability, then you have exactly the same skills as a high school graduate, and you should be able to do as well as any high school graduate. And so Heckman went back and looked at these huge databases of kids and how they had done in high school, what had happened to them, GED graduate versus dropout, and then what had happened to them in life. And what he found is that part of the hypothesis behind the GED was true. It was actually a very good measure of cognitive skill, and the GED recipients really were just as smart as high school graduates. But when he followed their path through life after high school, they didn't perform anywhere near as well as high school graduates. In fact, they performed almost exactly the same as high school dropouts in terms of things like certainly going on to college, but also things like chance that they would end up on welfare, chance that they would end up in trouble with the law. All of these really important life outcomes that we don't think of when we think of necessarily educational attainment. And so what Heckman theorized was that there was another set of skills that a high school diploma was really representing. And it was these things he called non-cognitive skills. It was just the ability to plan for the future, to get up in the morning and show up in school, to put up with a sometimes boring task, as high school often is, in order to achieve a future reward. And that really what a high school diploma was certifying was that a kid had all these skills. It wasn't certifying cognitive ability. It was really certifying non-cognitive ability. And that it was those skills that were helping kids do well in life.
So there's sort of what you learn to prepare for the math test. And then there's this other set of behavioral things that you learn that people just somehow don't know how to quantify.
Right. And so the GED study was really important in lots of ways, and it certainly set Heckman on this path to try to understand better what was going on. What it didn't do was give us any sort of indication of whether these skills were, well, first of all, what these skills even really were, but also whether they were changeable at all, whether it was possible to teach these skills.
Now, we know anybody who has gone to college, who has a kid in college, who has a kid getting ready for college, anybody knows that the SATs or the ACTs or the achievement tests or the APs, these are measures by which college acceptance is so often judged, or it's a very important part of getting into college. Do you think that's really mistaken in just saying, sit down for this 3-hour test, we'll judge you in large part based on this?
Well, I don't think it's useless at all. I mean, I think it measures some very important skills and some skills that are important in college, no doubt about it. But some of the research that I was most struck by, especially when I was writing about college, was that when it comes to college persistence, not necessarily, you know, freshman GPA, but college persistence, who graduates from college, ACT and SAT scores are actually not a very good predictor at most colleges. And GPA is actually a better predictor. And this really challenges a lot of the thinking behind the ACT and the SAT. I went and read this Nick Lemon's book, The Big Test, which talks about the whole history of the SAT, how it came into being after World War II. It's a fascinating history. And the SAT really came into being because educators felt like GPA was too subjective. You know, how could you possibly compare, you know, the GPA of a kid at a rural school in Indiana with a kid at an urban school in Chicago?
Right.
But what more recent researchers are finding is that in terms of predicting who is going to stay in school, GPA is incredibly predictive and a much better predictor than an SAT or an ACT score. And my thinking certainly behind why that is that there's a real correlation between GPA and non-cognitive skills. You know, you can actually, I mean, we all kind of know this, you can It's hard to improve your SAT scores. I know there are some, you know, test prep places that have shown that you can. But in terms of real improvement, it's hard to change your IQ, certainly, in any big way. But it is possible to change your GPA simply by working harder, you know, by applying yourself more, by being more resourceful and creative in terms of how you get your work done. And those same sorts of skills, that same sort of ability to persevere, to organize your thoughts, to stay focused on a task, all of those things are incredibly useful when a child gets to college in terms of predicting who's going to make it through all 4 years.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio, and we're talking to Paul Tough, author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. So, Paul Tough, if the dean of admissions of a college said, listen, we are ready to redo the way that we accept people, what would you say to them? Would you say, really focus on GPA, really focus on an essay, really focus on an interview? What would be the best way, in your view, given all the research you've done, to really figure out who's going to succeed in life?
Well, there's actually, was talking not long ago with a man who has done a lot of thinking in terms of how college admissions should change, a man named Robert Sternberg, who was the head of admissions at Tufts for a while and is now at Oklahoma State.
I've spoken to him, yeah.
Great. So you know that he first developed at Tufts, I think, a program called Kaleidoscope, which looks at a much broader set of skills. So it doesn't throw out the ACT and the SAT altogether, but it looks at the non-cognitive skills that he is able to demonstrate are going to be more predictive of how well kids do in school.
Right.
It's still pretty experimental. He's only been doing it for a few years, and he's now, you know, trying it at Oklahoma State. But his early data suggests, and I think he's right, that looking at a broader set of skills, if you're doing college admissions, will actually, you know, it's not that it will give you, you know, a more sort of diverse population or something like that, although it may do that as well. It's that it will give you a more successful population. It will actually better predict the kids who are going to make it through 4 years of college.
Yeah, I don't know if Tufts still does this, but it used to be, as of a couple of years ago, that kids would often make videos of themselves explaining mm-hmm. why they wanted to come to Tufts, what set them apart, these sort of outlets for creativity, very different from what you would think of as a normal application process.
Yes, exactly. And I think there's really something to that. So I spent, and a lot of the colleges that I was looking at, and that I think the most interesting research has been done on, is public universities. So not necessarily, you know, the most elite schools in the country, but public universities where most of our college students go and where the dropout rate is much higher, where we really have, a true educational policy problem to solve. And in those colleges especially, it feels like there's a need for a change. In fact, Robert Sternberg was saying that was one of the reasons he went from Tufts to Oklahoma State, is that being at a public university, it felt like this was the right place to be trying to make these changes, because the dropout problem there is a really big deal. And it is, you know, when I started reporting on education just like 10 years ago, people who were thinking about higher education were thinking about, and thinking about trying to reform it, were thinking about college access. The idea was, if we can just get more kids into college, they'll be fine, of course, once they get there. And no one was really talking about college persistence. And it's only in the last few years that we've been looking at the data and realizing that the real problem in American higher education right now is not the number of kids who are going to college, it's the number of kids who are graduating from college. The United States has the second highest dropout rate of all the OECD countries. And that's as our graduation rate has fallen really dramatically. So it you know, I think for any given school, it is a question of reforming your own admissions process and how you can experiment with that. For the country as a whole, I think it's a much bigger question of how we get more kids to graduate and to persist in college.
And, you know, I think one of the interesting things that you've done, too, is you've looked at some programs that have gotten so much attention. For example, KIPP, the Knowledge is Power program, which has sort of multiplied across the country, gotten a lot of attention, was featured on 60 Minutes as really very effective. But you talk about, and it has been in lots of ways very effective, but you talk about their first graduating middle school class in the Bronx in 1999. And one of the things that the founders discovered was that the kids who graduated from that middle school, who went on to, you know, great private schools, they didn't necessarily do as well in the end as the people who started the school thought they would. Why not? What happened to those sort of original graduates?
So the main KIPP educator that I've spent time speaking with is Dave Levin, who is one of the two KIPP founders and now runs KIPP's New York City schools. And he was the first principal of the KIPP Academy in the Bronx, and it was his kids, right? So in eighth grade they were famous. I say in the book they might be the most famous eighth grade class in American educational history. They had the highest scores in test scores in the Bronx. They had the fifth highest in all of New York City. But what Dave found as they got out of school and as they went through high school and through college was that a lot of them were dropping out. And he, you know, he wasn't able to say for sure exactly what was happening. But when he talked to them and when he got reports from them, it seemed to him like it was this question of character, it wasn't like they'd forgotten the math that he taught them in eighth grade. It was that when they got to college and had the kind of setback that, you know, all of us experience at various points, they didn't have the resources to deal with it, the inner strength. And especially for kids like these who were, you know, first generation college kids, the first kids in their family to go to college in most cases, they didn't have another kind of safety net to fall back on. You know, kids from well-off families, if they run into that kind of trouble in college, there's a whole support network to help them. And so these kids, you know, had lots of cognitive ability, lots of great math skills, but they didn't have that kind of non-cognitive skill, character strength, Dave likes to call it. And so Dave really started to, I think, retool the KIPP education based on that situation. You know, I should say that first KIPP graduating class, by some measure, didn't do that badly. 24-25% of them graduated from a 4-year colleges, which for the South Bronx is off the charts. It's an amazingly positive result. But you know, Dave Levin's goal was much higher than that. I think he wants 3/4 of KIPP graduates to graduate from 4-year colleges.
Right.
And so he has started to try to revamp the KIPP education to focus more on character strengths so that these kids will have the ability to persist right through college.
And it's interesting, you talk a lot about character there, and I feel like that's one of the things that the book orbits around so much. And a lot of people think of character as sort of innate. Your character is what it is, you're born a certain way. But you sort of venture into this territory of, if character is what makes people successful, can character be taught? And mm-hmm. and when you get into that question of, can you teach people character, mm-hmm. what did you find out?
So a lot of, let me just take a step back for 1 second to say that, yeah, it's part of the difficulty of this book is that there is this definitional issue, right? So we have a hard time talking about these skills. We don't have a great vocabulary for them. So economists like Heckman call them non-cognitive skills, and Dave Levin at KIPP calls them character strengths. You know, but there's problems with both of those terms. And the problem with talking about character, which is the word that I tend to use more in the book, is that we think of it as something you can't teach. And Dave is convinced that you can teach it. And he bases that idea on the work of these psychologists at the University of Pennsylvania, Martin Seligman and Angela Duckworth, who have been working for a long time to try to improve kids' grit and self-control and other character strengths. And so during the time that I was reporting, KIPP in New York introduced what they call a character report card. And the character report card is all about trying to change, I think, these kids and all of our definition of what character is from this idea that it is this, you know, something that's set in us from birth that we can't change at all, into this other definition, which is this collection of skills that can absolutely be learned and that are malleable and that parents can help kids develop and that teachers can help kids develop.
And a lot of those skills are very concrete. Sitting still, being organized, knowing what you're doing that day and then accomplishing those things. But a surprising number, I mean, I think you say in the book that almost 50% of kindergarten teachers say that half of their class or more cannot follow directions well. And if you can't follow directions well, then sort of what you know, chances there at teaching the alphabet or math or anything that proceeds from being able to listen, understand, sit still, and sort of be quiet and absorb a little bit.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I guess I would say two things. One is that in terms of the skills that are important in kindergarten, I think absolutely a big part of it is just being able to sit still, organize your thoughts, pay attention. And there's lots of really interesting research about how, you know, what happens in a child's early years has a huge effect on that. And especially how growing up in a chaotic or violent neighborhood or home has a very negative effect on your ability to exercise these executive functions, or what neuroscientists call them, the ability to just sort of think straight. What's interesting to me about the KIPP report card is that the character strengths that Dave Levin is talking about now aren't really just about sitting still. So there, you know, self-control is one of them, but so is zest and curiosity. And it's part of what I like about the Kip Report Card, that he has chosen this set of strengths that is a much more full definition of what a student needs to succeed. And some of these, you know, character strengths are kind of in conflict with each other, like zest and self-control are actually, in most of us, you know, in tension all the time. But I think the premise behind the report card is that you really do need both of them to be a great student. If you're just a student who sits still, I mean, it's great to be a student who can sit still and follow directions and do what you're supposed to do. But just doing that is not enough to succeed. Having zest, having excitement about your learning, having passion for what you're learning, enthusiasm, we all know those are things are extremely important in a student as well. We don't always, you know, want to encourage it in middle school students, but I think they make a great case that you should, because it is, we know that it is what you need in order to be successful in college. You need to have your own intellectual interests.
I want to talk about some of the biological actual implications of what your life is like, and about both rich kids and poor kids, which you touch on in terms of building character. My guest is writer Paul Tough, and his book is How Children Succeed: Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. I'm Kara Miller, and the conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. If you're just tuning in, my guest is writer Paul Tough. He has spent time in some of Chicago's toughest neighborhoods working with teens, and he's collaborated with educator Jeffrey Canada on a book about the Harlem Children's Zone. And what it takes for kids to make it is something that he thinks a lot about. And it's also the topic of his new book, How Children Succeed. You can catch him tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Harvard Bookstore. And Paul Tough, I think one of the really interesting studies that you look at, and it's actually sort of a collection of studies, looks at how biology, people's biology, which you think is innate, you can't change your, you know, eye color, your hair color, and obviously you can, but not innately, you can't change the hair growing out of your head. How much that is actually affected by experiences early in life. So I'm just going to read a little piece from your book. Gradually, Dr. Burke Harris became convinced of what at first seemed a radical idea, that in neighborhoods like Bayview, Hunters Point, and Roseland, many of the problems we generally think of as social issues, the province of economists and sociologists, are actually best analyzed and addressed on the molecular level, deep down in the realm of human biology. So what did this doctor find in terms of how what has happened to you early in life affects your health, your well-being later in life?
So I'd love to just say a little bit about Dr. Burke Harris. So
sure.
She's a pediatrician at this. She started her own clinic in Bayview Hunters Point, which is a really low-income neighborhood in San Francisco. And when she started, she you know, had just graduated from Harvard School of Public Health, and she felt like she knew exactly what you were supposed to do as a doctor working with underserved populations. And so she got a lot of patients in. She helped them with their immunizations. She got them the right medicines. But she felt a couple of years into it, like she really wasn't helping them with the real problems in their lives. They were growing up in a violent neighborhood, often in chaotic homes, and they just seemed stressed out and traumatized in a way that seemed to be having a much bigger effect on them than you know, any immunization could help to fix. And so she started her own investigation into the science around what happens in early development, and especially about what happens with kids growing up with trauma and stress. And so the two main fields that she looked into, one is called neuroendocrinology, which is the interaction between the brain and the stress system, and the other is stress physiology, which is how stress affects our physical development. And so she sort of led me into these sciences. I wouldn't have read all this stuff, I don't think, without her. But it's fascinating stuff about how powerful stress is in the early years of life. There's something called the HPA axis, which is basically our stress thermometer, our stress response system. And it's developed to, you know, respond to stresses. It developed when we were, you know, living on the African savannas and trying to run away from cheetahs. And it's really good for that sort of thing. You know, when you're suddenly stressed out, all of these things happen at once. Your heart rate increases, your mouth gets dry, your palms get sweaty. All of this stuff is really good if you're running away from a cheetah. It's not so good for the sorts of stresses that we experience in daily life. And it's really not good if you're, 6 months old and you're surrounded by violence and chaos and stress. And that what happens to kids when they're in that sort of environment, it's what one doctor at Harvard calls toxic stress. The stress just becomes too much for them to deal with. And it changes the development of the body and the brain in ways that you can actually see in brain scans. And these changes creating, when you have dysregulation in your HPA axis, it's a problem in all sorts of ways. It creates health problems down the road, not only in terms of sort of behavioral things like smoking and drinking and overeating, but also things that have nothing to do with behavior, heart disease and liver disease and all kinds of life expectancy issues.
I was going to say, that was what was so striking to me, that we all know behavior, if you smoke, then it's much more likely you're going to get young lung cancer, but you could prevent that by not smoking. I'm just going to read one more excerpt because I thought it was so striking. And this is talking about people who had adverse childhood experiences. So here it is from your book. Compared to people with no history of adverse childhood experiences, people with at least 4 adverse childhood experiences were twice as likely to smoke, 7 times more likely to be alcoholics, 7 times more likely to have had sex before age 15, twice as likely to have been diagnosed with cancer, twice as likely to have heart disease, twice as likely to have liver disease, and that's just a bit of it. It goes on from there. Yeah. And you, some of those things, you just don't think of being at all related to what you do in life. You know, I mean, right? Heart disease. I mean,
absolutely. And even when they, and what these scientists who did the ACEs study found is that even when they controlled for those behaviors, you know, things like smoking and overeating can lead to liver disease and heart disease. But even when they controlled for those behaviors, there was some process going on whereby the early trauma was creating these physical problems. And that goes back to the HPA axis. It goes back to the effect of stress on the developing body. What is particularly interesting to me about what Nadine Burke-Harris and others have found is that it's not just your health. So the health is a huge part of it, but the same sorts of negative experiences that a child can have early in life are also causing problems with cognitive development, and especially the development of this particular set of cognitive skills called executive functions, which are sort of what are sometimes called the air traffic control center for the brain, the cognitive functions that control the way that we think, our ability to organize our thoughts and keep things in our short-term memory. And then they also affect our mental health, so that when you have these sorts of experiences early on, you're more likely to be prone to depression and anxiety of all kinds. And so I spoke to some of Dr. Burke's patients who she hadn't been able to help early on because she hadn't started her clinic. This one young woman named Manisha Sullivan, who I met just after her 18th birthday. One of the things that was so useful for me with Manisha, and so sort of striking and in some ways heartbreaking about Manisha's story, is that she's very expressive about what's going on with her, and she really represented in herself what these scientists have found, that she thought she had this very stressful childhood. She'd been in foster care, bouncing from one foster care home to another, separated from her mother and father, and always kind of yearning for them. And she just described to me how, as an 18-year-old, she was overwhelmed with anxiety. She was afraid of losing her father, losing her daughter, afraid of planes falling from the sky on her. Her hands shook. She was losing her hair. And she was, of course, having lots of trouble in school as well. And so in some ways, she was, to me, the embodiment of all of this stuff that I've been reading in these, neuroendocrinology journals about the way that early stress and trauma affects the development of kids in terms of their health, their mental health, and their cognitive abilities.
I'm Kara Miller. I'm talking with Paul Tough, and his new book is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. That picture you leave us with somebody who's very stressed, you know, been in foster homes. She has a child by the age of 16. You know, like you said, really hard for her, obviously, to focus on schoolwork when there's so much else that's taking up her brain space, and that may have actually affected her brain and her physiology. Okay, so that's a really tough problem. And, you know, we're obviously in the middle of a political season. We hear people arguing over, should we put more funding into vouchers? Should we have school choice? Should we put more money into public school? Do you feel sometimes like politicians or people in general are just missing the big picture if what they're really trying to do is create more successful kids?
I do feel like we're missing the big picture. I think that the way that we think about kids who are growing up in adversity, and certainly the way that our government is organized to interact with kids who are growing up in those environments, it's very much siloed. It's very much about, you know, dealing with each problem, to the extent we deal with their problems at all, it's dealing with each problem individually through a different agency, and usually dealing with the results of those problems down the road rather than trying to deal with those problems early on. You know, what we know from the science is that intervening early in these children's lives could make a huge difference. Intervening with their parents and with their families in the first few years of life could make a huge difference. But instead, you know, we tend to have, I mean, you know, with Monisha Sullivan, the government had a huge role in her life, but it had a role in her life through the foster care system, which is a very expensive way to try to deal with a child's problems, and was not, you know, was not at all helpful for Monisha. I mean, it kept her alive to the age of 18, but it left her really unhappy and unprepared in lots of ways. And so I feel like if we could look at neighborhoods like Bayview Hunter's Point and kids like Monisha Sullivan and say, first of all, that they are our responsibility, that this is the problem that we want to solve, and then just look, you know, scientifically at, okay, well, what do we need to do to solve these problems? Let's look at these problems as a whole rather than, you know, here's the foster care system, here's the education system, here's the public health system. I think we would end up with a very different approach to those neighborhoods and those kids. And it could be an approach that was cheaper, I think, because the way we spend money in those neighborhoods is really inefficient, but would also be much more effective at helping kids like Monisha.
So you'd try to intervene, it sounds like, a lot earlier with whatever it was, education, social work, rather than sort of dealing with the end products, which might be, you know, delivering children to young mothers or welfare or the sort of end product of not dealing with those kids early on.
Yeah, I would say it's two main things that I wish I could push public policy towards. One is certainly to intervene earlier and to think about how to intervene in the first few years of life, which I think means a very some rethinking about the relationship between government and families. You know, right now I think we mostly think that our public responsibility for kids begins on the first day of kindergarten, but that is not well supported by the scientific research that explains how much of brain development, how much of all kinds of development happens before the first day of kindergarten. So I think that would take some rethinking if we wanted to have a more effective system. And then the other thing I think needs to change is to make things more comprehensive and integrated for kids in those neighborhoods, so that rather than having, you know, one intervention here and one intervention there, and, you know, these kids have to have a different caseworker for each agency that they're dealing with, to bring those services together. As I've said, I really do believe in early intervention, but I also don't think that it's the whole story. I think that there is a whole lot that you can do to help kids in adolescence as well, and that the most effective interventions are ones that help kids at all stages of their lives. And you know, in the book, I talk about lots of kids who do grow up in very difficult circumstances with Monisha, but have had much better outcomes than she's been able to have, who are in college now, who are really overcoming a lot of those adversities, and who didn't necessarily get help early on. These are just with adolescent interventions. So in some ways, it's a split message, but I think it's an important one, that intervening early is super important, and we should do more of it, but it's not too late if we don't get to intervene early.
We've been talking sort of a lot about kids on the poorer end of the spectrum. We talked about KIPP in the Bronx. Let's go now to another part of the Bronx, much more affluent part. You looked at a Riverdale Country School where tuition starts at about $40,000 a year. But there is also a concern there. When you talk to affluent kids or affluent parents or the head of this affluent school about how you get kids to be successful, how you get kids to build character, when in a lot of ways, and you alluded to this before, there is a safety net. There's is so clearly for them a safety net, and maybe they don't have to deal with adversity. So how do you build character at the other end of the spectrum?
It was very interesting to me spending time at Riverdale Country School. So I'd reported before I worked on this book, reported mostly in low income neighborhoods. And the reason I ended up in Riverdale was because of KIPP, because David Levin, had just started this collaboration between him and, the psychologist I was talking about at the University of Pennsylvania and Dominic Randolph, the head of school at Riverdale Country School. Both Dave and Dominic had felt independently the same kind of thing. So I'd talked about how Dave had felt like there was something missing in the education that he was giving his students, that he hadn't found a way to develop their character strengths effectively enough. And Dominic was feeling the same way. So just like Dave's school, you know, on paper, Dominic was doing fantastically. He was getting lots of kids into Ivy League schools. But what he felt was that he wasn't giving these kids, or Riverdale hadn't found a way to give these kids that same character, that same inner strength that was going to let them deal with setbacks when they came. And so for these kids, it usually didn't, they weren't dropping out of college, because if you're in Riverdale Country School, you've got a support system around you that kind of propels you right through college and catches you if you fall. But then these kids would get out into the world, into adulthood, and it was then that they would often find themselves lost. Then they would encounter some sort of setback and not have any way to deal with it. And Dominic talked a lot about the importance of failure. It was really striking to me the way that he talked about it. He said, you know, these character strengths like grit and self-control, they really come from failure. And in our high-achieving academic environments, no one really fails anything. And I think he's right. You know, I think there's lots of evidence that kids who are going to schools like that, whether they're private schools or just, you know, high-achieving public schools, they're really stressed out. You know, they're doing a ton of homework. They've got, they're scheduled, you know, from around the clock. They're under a lot of pressure, but they're not really facing real challenges. They're mostly just following orders. You know, there's a very clear set of tasks that they need to do, and they're totally stressed out to complete all those tasks. But Dominic's point is that is not actually how you develop the kind of character that's going to make you happy and successful in life. The way you develop character is through failure, is through actually trying something different, challenging yourself, taking a class that you don't know that you're going to ace, trying some other experience that you don't know whether you're going to succeed at, and actually failing sometimes and discovering that you can pick yourself back up again. And so the point Dominic makes, and I think I've heard this from lots of other teachers and parents as well, is that in these communities, in affluent communities today, parents are so protective of their kids that they don't give them this really valuable opportunity to fail. I think part of it is just this anxiety that, you know, the path to and through the most elite colleges is so competitive and so essential that if you, you know, let up on the gas pedal even for a little bit, if you get a B instead of an A+ on one course, you're not going to get into Harvard. But I think there's a real case to be made that the more valuable thing that you can learn in high school is how to fail, how to manage adversity.
Well, and one final question for you. Since you've been following the Riverdale Country School and since they've been thinking about failure, have they noticed anything in policies they've implemented in the way that kids have changed in their ability to, let's say, you know, take chances and pick themselves up?
Well, it's interesting. What Dominic is trying to do at Riverdale is really a whole cultural shift. So at KIPP, they've got this character report card, which is you know, sort of something that, was created in collaboration with Riverdale. But Riverdale did not introduce the character report card. One of the things that Dominic said to me is, you know, if he introduced a report card that involved curiosity and zest, that, you know, the next day there would be curiosity and zest tutors charging $400 an hour
right.
at Riverdale. And so, you know, in his, and that's exactly the opposite of what he wants to push kids toward. So it's harder for him because he doesn't have, you know, he's not able to use the character report card in the way that I think Kip is intelligently using it as this way, as this sort of talking point to help kids and parents and teachers talk about character. And so he's doing it much more sort of dialectically. He's talking about it in assemblies and to teachers. But it's a difficult culture shift for him. And I think he and the school are still struggling with it, because when you're in that kind of community, that the you know, the cognitive hypothesis is very strong and very overwhelming. And I think it's really difficult to challenge it. And it's one of those situations where, you know, who's going to go first? Is it, you know, is it the parents or the principals of schools like Riverdale or the college admissions folks?
Right.
The system is so tightly integrated that I think it's really difficult for anyone in that triangle to take the chance and say, you know, this isn't working. We got to try something different.
But your book does challenge it. I've been talking with writer Paul Tuff, and his new book is How Children Succeed: Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. And if you're in the area, you can catch him tomorrow night at 7 at Harvard Bookstore. Paul Tuff, thank you so much for joining us.
Can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
Sorry, it's not at Harvard Bookstore. It's at the Gutman Library at Harvard.
Okay, at the Ed School, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, great.
Great,
thanks
very much.
And Callie Crossley is back in the studio with me. Hey, Callie.
Kara, your guest, Paul Tuff, was talking about the impact that the dropout rate has on kids succeeding. And we're going to continue that conversation with a filmmaker who's making a documentary about students who are graduating against the odds.
Interesting. Any students from Massachusetts?
Yep. They've been filming students at New Bedford High School this weekend. We'll hear some of their stories.
I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio.